Hi, folks. Denise Howell here, joining Evan Brown and I next on Twill. We've got Ryan Radia and Warren Allen, and we've got a little bit of everything for you today. Lawsuits both serious and silly, getting our Comic-Con on, lots about the NSA, and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 220, recorded July 19, 2013. The resounding meh. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TWILL. And by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter TWILL. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We've got an amazing panel of folks this week. I'm so excited to talk about all the important things that have been happening in particular this week, and some funny and sillier ones, too. And we've got some great folks to do it. Joining us from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is Ryan Radia. Hello, Ryan.
Hello. Good to be here.
Great to see you. Ryan is a prolific writer and deep thinker, and we're going to definitely get into some serious, profound kinds of discussions today that Ryan will definitely shed some good light on. And not that you're not also serious and profound, Warren, but with a bit of a more legal hacker streak. Warren Allen coming to us from New York and the Legal Hackers. Hello, Warren.
Hi, Denise. Thanks for having me. Definitely. It's an honor. You know, last year at this time, actually, I was listening to the show, I think, while studying for the bar exam, while I should have been studying for the bar exam. So, yeah, it's a real privilege.
Yeah, we're right about that time, right? When people are studying for and about to take the bar. So congratulations on not being in that situation this year. And exactly. You're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of Legal Hackers too, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, actually we started Legal Hackers while I was a 3L at Brooklyn Law School with Jonathan Askin's Blip Clinic. It was myself, my friend Phil Weiss, and our friend John Randall. All of us, we started it as a legal hackathon, and there was so much interest from it that we've kept it going as a meetup pretty much each month. And we've done since then, I guess it's probably about an event each month looking at one area where law just isn't keeping up with technology. So it's been great, gotten great reaction, and we actually just passed 500 members. So it's growing too. So that's always a good sign.
That's wonderful. We were joking just before we went on air here that we've done 220 shows and maybe haven't solved anything yet, but you guys have a much better shot of doing that. Why don't you explain for anyone who hasn't heard us plug Legal Hackers on the show before what you do?
Sure. So the whole idea is basically, it's all revolving around this idea that law doesn't keep up with technology, which obviously, you know, you cover each week. We look at specific areas for each meetup. We talk about, you know, where are these issues? What's the law behind it? Where's the technology at this point? And then we try to, in some way, at least look towards solutions. And that's something we're always working on. We want to get, you know, developers, technologists, policy wonks, and lawyers sort of all in the same room together to talk and work through really interesting potential solutions. So we've had some really great, you know, companies come in, for instance, like Docracy, which is a New York-based startup that offers sort of crowdsourced legal documentation. We've had a bunch of really interesting ideas just sort of pitched out and that have been developed from there. So we're really excited about it. And I think we've got some really cool programs lined up in the future, too.
And that's kind of what you're up to at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, too, isn't it, Ryan, on more of a scholarly, intellectual level, perhaps? Isn't it sort of a think tank?
We are a think tank, although we also play a big role in what's happening in Washington. So it's not just doing what a say law professor would do, thinking about the theories underpinning information law, but actually talking with lawmakers, with the folks who work on these issues in D.C. on a day-to-day basis about what draft legislation should look like, trying to make sure they understand the sort of the complexities that underlie a lot of the issues that come up, especially for people who don't devote themselves to the law relating to technology and information policy.
Well, Evan, so if we haven't solved anything yet, perhaps our guests can. So we're glad to have them. And it's great to see you again, Evan, too.
Yes, great to see you. I missed being here last week. I was out of town. I was actually in my hometown of Bedford, Indiana. This time last week, I spoke at it's called the Becky Skillman Leadership Institute. It's a conference there. And I spoke about, you know, the very themes that that we brought up already here, law and technology, and how those two struggle with one another from time to time. So certainly missed being on the show, but last week's show was an awesome show, as should be expected. But really looking forward to this, and happy to be back. And you know, this ought to be a really fun conversation.
It should be. And you know, one of our guiding principles here on the show is to always lead with porn whenever we can. So that's where I know just where to go on the rundown today. There is a lawsuit pending. The story broken by Above the Law, which is sort of a humorous and snarky legal website. And it, as we do, revels in lawsuits where you sort of roll your eyes at the fact that the court system can support such things. But in this particular case, it's actually right in keeping with a theme we've discussed a lot on the show. And that is the role and boundaries of internet filtering and what people's responsibilities should be with respect to that complicated topic. There is a plaintiff. His name is Chris Sevier, who has filed a lawsuit against Apple in California. And his issue with Apple is that he was able to view porn on his computer. And he would like Apple to do something about that. He would like Apple to sell devices in safe mode, where if you were over 18, you could request a password that would then enable you to have more free use of your device to view material of a sexual content. So the plaintiff here is concerned not just for children, but for adults with the issue of internet porn addiction. And he is representing himself in pro per. You know, I don't think that anybody considering this lawsuit thinks that it's really going to go anywhere. So it's really more of a novelty item than a serious legal challenge. I'm sure the plaintiff probably doesn't feel that way. Isn't he a lawyer himself, Evan?
That's what I read on the I guess there was actually a report on what Above the Law had reported on, and mm-hmm. He at least was a lawyer. If we're tracking the same guy here, and I don't want to, you know, I want to be sure to be real careful here that we're not talking about the wrong people. So I just want to make it clear. I'm just talking about what I have read here, that this mm-hmm. lawyer or this guy was a lawyer, that he was suspended from the practice of law. I don't think he was disbarred, you know, permanently for some mental infirmity, you know, a disability. So, you know, if indeed that is the case, then that might, you know, explain some of what's going on here. I mean, you're right, Denise. This lawsuit on the merits has no chance of going forward at all. I mean, if you read the complaint, it's like many self-filed complaints are, that just rambles on for page after page of material that certainly does not need to be in a federal complaint, you know, with notice pleading. You just got to essentially just set forth the elements of the claim and a little bit of facts to make them plausible to make that initial complaint stick to the wall. But there's just a lot of this rambling stuff about pornography and a bunch of just, you know, pretty crazy stuff about Apple and all the decisions that's it made. So of course the legal issues that are raised, if any, in the complaint are non-substantive, and this case will go nowhere and will be dismissed quickly. And, you know, hopefully the appropriate sanctions will be applied, the court will impose the appropriate sanctions on this. But I guess it raises the larger question about the service provider, the platforms, the intermediaries' role in ensuring that users are protected, so to speak, from content that they may find objectionable. The big 800-pound gorilla in the room with this is the First Amendment, obviously. It's problematic for anyone to impose restrictions on content. I mean, clearly Apple's a private actor, so as we've said many times, they wouldn't be subject to the restrictions of the First Amendment or, you know, have to not censor content if they wanted. But I mean, isn't it just weird? I mean, this whole thing is just weird that we're even talking about this, this lawsuit. The larger issue is, you know, what role participants in each of these transactions can play in making good decisions about the kind of content that ought to be out there. And this seems like a pretty weak attempt to address one of those issues. And it is nothing more. And I think you said this, Denise, this is kind of, it's just a little novelty item that merely points to the larger, perhaps more important issues.
Right. And that's why I put it in, is even though this lawsuit, I don't think any of us probably think this lawsuit will go anywhere, but it's not too far from the law that is being hammered out in England right now that governs ISPs, which is going to require filtering to be on by default. And it's coming from the same place, that a third-party intermediary is more effective and more helpful in being able to keep porn off of people's systems. And that seems to be what people want, at least in England, by default. I think in the U.S. we might have different sensibilities. We certainly have the First Amendment that might come more into play. Although the lawsuit itself is sort of comical, the issue is not. Warren, what do you think the legal hackers would do with the issue of internet filtering?
I don't know. Internet filtering is something, I mean, generally, I think many of our constituents aren't really huge fans of. Generally, when I read about this case, there's something very comical about it. When you read the headline, at least, there's also something, I'd read the same thing as Evan, and it seems like there's something also probably potentially some sad backstory involved if those reports are true. I think, you know, just looking at this, it seems like this reinforces the need for laws like 47 U.S.C. 230 of the Communications Decency Act, where, you know, we don't put this responsibility on the intermediary service provider, where they're not actually responsible for creating or having some kind of editorial role in the content involved. So, I mean, if we continue to want great and constantly available services, I think that we need to keep having things like 47 U.S.C. 230. It's as Eric Goldman, he frequently blogs about a lot of similarly kind of outrageous claims that should be struck down by the same law. And, you know, it does a lot of work ultimately, and it allows us to have some of the nice things that we ultimately wind up getting. So I think that we would just sort of point back to 47 U.S.C. 230.
Ryan, what do you think about this issue in general, the lawsuit in particular, and what England is doing?
Well, I find the lawsuit reasonably humorous, which is not to say that porn addiction is not a serious issue, but I never thought of bringing a complaint alleging that pornography gives rise to unfair competition with one's spouse, which is one of the allegations in the
That's
complaint.
A good one.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. So, but, and also in terms of people who use Apple products, the complaints that I've heard tended to be more, it's too hard to get porn, not it's too easy. So it's sort of an interesting swap of the normal way that people complain about Apple actually being too restrictive. In terms of the broader questions about filtering, there is, of course, as you mentioned, the UK law. There are also actually a number of countries across the world, not just regimes like Turkey and Iran, who we would expect to censor, but also countries like Australia that have long maintained policies that required varying degrees of filtering by internet service providers. And at least from a legal perspective, the reason that we do not have those sorts of mandates in the United States is, as you mentioned, the First Amendment. There was actually a law passed by Congress known as COPA, the I believe it's the Children's Online Protection, Child Online Protection Act. COPA, not to be confused with COPPA, which we may talk about later, but COPA was a law that said that websites that offer material that is harmful to minors have to take steps to restrict access to minors to that content. And that law was held unconstitutional by several federal judges. It was ultimately permanently enjoined, and the Supreme Court declined to review that case. So in the United States, if say Congress were to enact a law again that say said that Apple had to filter out pornography, that would with almost 100% certainty be very quickly enjoined and overruled as a violation of the First Amendment, because it's focusing on protected speech. It's a content-based regulation. Of course, voluntary restrictions on content filtering by companies like Apple is commonplace, and I think it's often a good thing. Companies sometimes may go too far. Sometimes they may not go far enough. My preferred approach is the default that we won't show you pornography, but if you want it, we'll let you see it. Maybe not for an internet provider, but for an ecosystem operator. So Google, of course, has Safe Search. It's on by default. You can turn it off if you want to see all the great stuff that's out there. But you can't always opt out of these filters. So one of the funnier stories that's come up in recent years is that Google's autocomplete feature, which suggests what you're searching for before you finish typing your search term, that is filtered and you cannot turn it off, probably because anytime you started typing anything, if it were off, you would see how depraved the internet really is. But in fact, there's actually a person that sits there in Mountain View whose job it is to go through autocomplete terms and blacklist ones that are considered offensive. So these companies, Apple, Google, and so forth, have to test the waters and try different approaches to filtering because their users really have a diverse array of preferences. Does the burden rest with parents, properly understood, to set up filtering if their kids are using an iPad or the iPhone? Or is it better for Apple to take those steps and create those filters and then let people who want to see everything that's out there opt out? It's kind of a law and economics question about who's the least cost avoider of pornography and what's the best way to suit a diverse user base that we haven't worked out, which is why I think it's valuable that the First Amendment stands as a barrier to Congress or states making laws that would resemble what's happening in the UK. Because I think the idea of a filtered internet is pretty problematic, especially when you're talking about content that hasn't been deemed by a court to be unlawful, which of course is not the case with not obscene pornography here in the United States.
Right. And the only thing I would add to that is that the lawmakers and folks who did want to see filtering come through in some form did get a small victory. I forget the name of the law now, but it's been in effect for several years and it's tied to E-rate discounts and public schools. So that public schools who accept the E-rate discounts have to filter. And that's been found to be constitutional because of the voluntary nature of the participation, even though some may say that's extortion. You know, you're going to take money away from schools. But that was sort of the accommodation that was made, at least as far as schools go. The internet we all use in our home, like the gentleman in this lawsuit, is up for grabs. And I do think it's kind of ironic that he decided to come after Apple, which is, as you say, Ryan, pretty well known for being pretty closed about what it will allow in the App Store, for example. Evan, any more thoughts on this?
Yes, one way in which private industry is testing the waters, to use Ryan's term, on this is almost a brand new story. I just saw this today, too late to put it into our show notes for today, but apparently Tumblr, which is under new ownership now, is no indexing. Do they still call them Tumble logs? Tumblr accounts that contain adult content. So if you go to your favorite Tumblr porn blog, and look at view the source, you'll likely see a nofollow tag in there as well, which means that porn is not showing up in porn on Tumblr is not showing up in Google searches anymore. Violet Blue wrote a story about that, just today. So it might be something we want to talk about a little bit later on a later episode. I don't know where Violet Blue writes these days, but she of course, in her angle was talking about the outrage that everybody is feeling about that. But it's certainly a lesser step than what some folks figured Tumblr might do under new ownership of doing away with porn altogether on Tumblr. You know, it's faced litigation from Perfect 10. I mean, but what provider that allows porn hasn't faced litigation from Perfect 10, but recently. So that's one thing that the way private industry is doing nothing less than working with filtering out content in that way.
Right. Okay, Warren, here's another good topic for a legal hacker meetup. And that is COPPA that Ryan just alluded to. This doesn't deal with adult content online, but instead collecting information from and about children. Those rules just got updated as of July 1st. So if you haven't reviewed your company's COPPA policy and you're a company that might be getting information about children, either directly or obliquely, you should take a look at the new rule and what it might mean for you. And in particular, I think mobile companies have to be concerned about this, just because I look around and see the extent to which kids are using mobile apps and information about them, whether it's personal information or just information about their gameplay or their purchase habits, is being collected. And COPPA is very sensitive to those issues and is doing more to require parental consent before information is gathered. So, Warren, what do you think? Do people and companies really grasp what the requirements are out there?
I don't think they do for the most part. To a large degree, COPPA, first of all, basically applies to kids under the age of 13, which is why if you look at a lot of terms of service, they just say sort of generally the website that this is not meant at all to be used by kids under the age of 13. By signing on or continuing to use this service, you represent that you are over the age of 13 and you're not a child and we're not going to be collecting information about you. I'm not sure, given the new rule, if that necessarily is really going to work. If you have actual knowledge that someone is under the age of 13, then you should really, you're going to fall under COPPA's scope and potentially have to deal with the FTC if you're not actually complying with it. I know generally the risk for a lot of small companies, at least, is, too great for them to actually worry about trying to comply with this law. So I think, unfortunately, it does wind up pushing people away from offering good services to kids generally. And I don't know if that's necessarily the best thing that we should be doing, given the fact that we want kids in today's generations and who are our future leaders and so forth to be really well versed in social networking to some degree and to really be used to using these different kinds of services that are really, the future, and trying to really get a handle on, shall we say, hacking, technology overall, the understanding how to code, for instance. If a student who's trying to learn how to code wants to go into a chat room and they're sharing personal details, COPPA, as I understand it at least, and I'm no expert on it, would require some indication of parental consent to that. The whole idea of COPPA really is trying to get the parents in the middle of what is sort of, as a result of technology, generally a one-to-one transaction, the user and the computers that they're trying to access, the other server. So interjecting sort of a parent to provide some kind of physical, or some kind of non-internet-based consent can really be, I think, potentially problematic. Obviously, there are legitimate concerns with, collecting all kinds of kids' data, marketing to children, et cetera, et cetera. These are legitimate concerns, and it's really overall a tough balancing act that we the FTC has tried to really put into place. I don't know if it's 100% successful, but it's definitely going to continue to make a major impact on the mobile services and really beyond overall as we have this new rule in place.
What do you think, Ryan? Is this rule just not contemplating how people and their kids really use technology? Is it impractical?
It is impractical, and I think it's worrisome to think about what this might mean for as Warren pointed out, mobile app developers, many of which are small businesses for whom $5,000 or $10,000 in lawyers' fees it actually makes a big deal. So the general thrust of this law, COPPA, is basically if you're an internet company, don't intentionally collect information about young children that could be used to harass them, to find them, and so forth. And that's reasonable enough, but the devil is in the details. This new rule takes the existing, the previous regime, and expands it in a way that is troubling. So for one thing, the actual statute talks about collecting personal information that permits someone to contact online or in the real world a specific individual, in other words, a child. But the new rule says that an IP address is considered personal information. Now, without getting into the big debate over what's PII in the broader privacy context, at least as far as children are concerned, I think there's a big difference between collecting a phone number or a home address or even an email on the one hand from an IP address that really, you know, you can't tie to a child without either other pieces of information like an email address, which you're not supposed to collect, or by going to the provider and serving them the process. There's also the concern that this rule encourages companies to engage in more age verification than they currently do, because it creates a sort of a safe harbor for websites that take certain measures like age screening to determine who's using their site. Now, sort of ironically, this has the result of reducing the anonymity of people who are over 13. So to prove that you're over 13, you have to submit information. It could be a credit card number. It could be, you know, it could probably include your email, your home address, and so forth. And the websites are allowed to collect that. If you are over 13, they, of course, cannot if you say that you are not. So by encouraging internet providers, app developers, and the like to verify the ages of their users, they're making it harder for services that are either directed at children or who know that some of their users are children to do business in a way that allows anonymous usage. So this rule has some pretty substantial side effects, both from a regulatory cost compliance perspective and from a First Amendment speech perspective that I think the FTC didn't adequately consider. The idea of limiting collection of information about young children, and it really needs to be narrowed to the cases where we're actually worried about companies collecting information which either their employees might misuse or which somebody who gets that information might misuse. But IP addresses of 12-year-olds with no other information, or maybe just perhaps a single username with no email, that doesn't seem to be a threat to any children, as far as I can tell, in the way that Congress envisioned when it wrote this law.
We should probably come back to that when we talk about the NSA lawsuits in a minute and what can be gleaned from metadata. But before we do that, Evan, what do you think about the COPPA update?
Well, just 2 points to tack on to what the guests have already said, because that's all great commentary. One would just be to underscore that, you know, this is something that's costly for businesses to comply with. And the other point is kind of goes along with that. I think it's of limited utility most of the time. I think that the biggest risk to children and exploitation of their personal information online and the you know, accordingly, the risk to their privacy comes from those kids who are, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12 or so, who go onto sites that aren't targeted for children, you know, Facebook, for example, and lie about their age. And, you know, since if the provider doesn't have actual knowledge that the person is under 13, there's nothing triggered. You know, that's, I think, a huge spot, a huge vector for which information can be released. That's harmful, and that COPPA doesn't do anything for. Notwithstanding the great cost and expense incurred by websites and platforms to try and be compliant. So there's a huge problem left unsolved, and I don't know how to solve the problem otherwise.
Yep. Back to the legal hackers then, Warren, I guess. But as a parent, I can say that I'm glad that there are at least some roadblocks in the way. And though cost and difficulty of doing business is a concern, information is money these days. And when the information's coming from kids, I think, it's worthwhile to have both companies and parents have some consideration of that fact. And even if it's just this sort of impractical, mom, you got to click this box or I can't play this game, it at least it makes the parent think about, what the game is doing or gathering or may encourage the child to do while playing and who they may be interacting with.
Yeah.
I know it's kind of big brother-ish, but I think maybe a lot of parents need that reminder.
No, I totally agree. I definitely think that's true. One thing that I've never really understood well about COPPA is how we're actually going to get a good indicator that it's a parent who's providing consent for the use of the service. My understanding is there's been called in confirmations of that. Yeah, the service will call in a home number and an adult has to answer and provide some kind of verification that yes, my child can use this service before they'll actually green light it. That seems to me to be very kind of inefficient. One legal hack, if we're proposing stuff, would be that I might like to suggest or at least see in out there would be some kind of really good verifiable confirmation of identity for this that you could use in a really simple, cost-effective way for the service provider and for both parties so that we could get so that this rule could theoretically at least, work well for everyone involved. I mean, whenever I think of these kinds of parental consents, I think that a lot of kids are probably pretty savvy if they want to wind up using a service like this, so that they can find some way of generating some kind of consent that will probably fool most service providers, even if the service provider is also likely aware that it can be easily tricked. So that's one of my main issues, I guess, when it comes to actually requiring parental consent. So I think that's a potential solution that we haven't seen yet.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point. Of course, there are going to be workarounds for everything. Let's make parental consent our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you're a lawyer looking for some continuing legal education credit, if you head on over to the TWIT Wiki at wiki.twit.tv and find the TWIL page there, we've got lots of information about all the U.S. jurisdictions at any rate and how you might apply to your jurisdiction to get credit for the show. People in other professions have sought accreditation in those arenas too. So have at it. Sometimes people need to demonstrate that they've actually listened to the show. So we drop these passphrases in. And I'm sure there would be a workaround for that too. Somebody out there harvesting our passphrases and posting them up somewhere. But we're doing our best, just like the legislators with COPPA. So hopefully that will be enough and you can apply for credit in your jurisdiction. And aside from just enjoying all the great intellectually stimulating things that we discuss here on the show, you can get a little help with your professional status as well. Let's move on, since there have been some big developments this week on the privacy front. All right, so we were waiting for the flood of constitutional challenges to the various surveillance programs that came to light in the last month or so at the hands of leaker Edward Snowden, and they've come. In fact, the floodgates opened this week. Epic has filed a challenge with the United States Supreme Court to the orders that are requiring Verizon to turn over data to the NSA and other phone companies as well. And in the lower federal courts, there is a significant lawsuit now pending, a new one, although there have been constitutional challenges pending for a while now to various surveillance programs. These are specifically targeted to the ones that have been in the headlines lately, and they're going after them from a plethora of perspectives on the plaintiff's side. We've got the EFF leading the charge, Tech Liberation, Tech Freedom is in there, a whole slew of folks leading this and challenging both PRISM and the telephone data gathering program that doesn't so much have a shorthand name for it. What are we calling it? Dragnet surveillance of phone records. That helps. Anyway, those lawsuits are now pending, and we've got the Fourth Amendment challenge, the Fifth Amendment challenge, and Ryan, what is the other constitutional basis that is problematic for these programs?
The three that have been identified are the First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment, and then they're also statutory counts.
Right. So off to the races with these. What do you think, Ryan? Give us your take.
Well, I'm glad that both of these lawsuits were filed. The first one that you mentioned, Epic, they're seeking what's known as a writ of mandamus from the Supreme Court, this extraordinary relief whereby the Supreme Court will hold that the appeals panel of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISA court, got it wrong when it authorized this program, the Dragnet Surveillance Program, or the Section 215 program, or I think it's 50 U.S.C. 1861 if you want to look up the statute. So the problem with Epic's suit, or the challenge, is that if you look at the FISA court's enabling statute, or for that matter, Title 28 of the U.S. Code, which establishes the procedure for the federal judiciary, there's actually nothing that expressly provides for the Supreme Court to review FISA court appeal decisions. It's not like a regular federal court of appeals that is subject to the review of the U.S. Supreme Court. So whether the Supreme Court will grant Epic's petition or not is a tough question, but my guess is it's somewhat unlikely. Never before has the Supreme Court ever agreed to review a FISA decision since the FISA court was created in 1978 and then expanded in 2001 and in subsequent laws. But however, the other suit, which I think is probably the most important lawsuit that's been filed about these programs since the Snowden revelations, is the one that the EFF filed. They're representing a really broad coalition of, I believe, 19 groups, making both constitutional and statutory arguments against the program. They call it the, quote, associational tracking program, which is a nice descriptor because, first, the goal of this program is to connect the links of people who were talking to one another, supposedly for purposes of ferreting out terrorists or perhaps to a lesser extent foreign intelligence operatives. But it's, of course, unlike some of the other surveillance programs like PRISM, this one is targeted at every American. The court order says that a phone call gets collected if both parties or one party is in the United States, which makes it really unlike most of the other programs that have come out over the years, which to varying degrees are at least designed to get at communications involving foreigners. Whatever one thinks about that, it's much more closely related to the purpose of the U.S. intelligence community, which is supposed to be engaging in intelligence gathering abroad for the most part, not domestically, which is, of course, why we have the FISA court in the first place, to constrain the ability of these agencies to do things like what they did under the Nixon administration. But getting back to the lawsuit, this is a very broad lawsuit filed by a number of groups in the Northern District of California. And they make some arguments that I think are pretty compelling. First is the First Amendment claim. Now, it might seem strange at first glance to say that if the government is collecting all phone records, who you call, who calls you, how long the calls are, when the calls are, possibly where they're made, although that's somewhat unclear given the court order. It might be hard to see how that's a First Amendment issue, but if you go back to the classic Supreme Court case in and NAACP v. Alabama, where the Supreme Court held that it was a violation of the First Amendment for the state of Alabama to require that out-of-state companies submit information that includes, among other things, who their members are, who their supporters are, that was a violation of the First Amendment, you start to see why, in fact, it's a pretty persuasive claim that EFF is making on behalf of its clients, that if every time a nonprofit, a church, an advocacy group places a phone call or receives a phone call, that's being collected by a federal government agency in secret and stored for, as far as we know, months, years, indefinitely, that's something that could well have a chilling effect on these groups' ability to do what they do, especially given that some of the groups that are part of this lawsuit have been, to varying extents, at odds with this administration or its predecessor. You've got groups that advocate for gun rights, the Council of American-Islamic Relations, which was alleged in a previous court filing by the government to be an unindicted co-conspirator with Hamas, and so forth. So if every time these groups are calling or getting a call from, say, a whistleblower inside government, a reporter, one of their donors, like the similar to the situation that the Supreme Court reviewed in the NAACP case, you have a sort of broad surveillance, even if not the content of their communications, the knowledge of who they're talking to that arguably could chill their ability to engage in what they do, which is protected speech, except insofar as it's deemed unlawful or there's been a specific court order. If you look at this recent scandal involving the Internal Revenue Service targeting Tea Party and conservative groups on for their applications for nonprofit status under Section 501 of the Internal Revenue Code, it's not a stretch to think that groups are going to be fearful about making phone calls when they're being collected in a massive government database somewhere. Maybe it'll be in Utah once this new data center is built. Then, of course, there are the other claims, the Fourth Amendment argument, which is that the government is seizing the information from the phone company, which if you look at the court order, is an accurate description. Verizon and as has been reported, other major phone companies are being compelled on an ongoing basis to hand over all of their phone records on all of their customers. Their customers, in fact, have a Fourth Amendment interest in those phone records, just as individuals, according to the Sixth Circuit and Warshak, have an expectation of privacy in their emails, and as the Supreme Court held in Katz, in their phone calls. Of course, there's this 1979 Supreme Court case, Smith v. Maryland, which held that, in fact, dial number information is not protected. But first, that was the government collecting information about one person where it, in fact, did have some suspicion. But also, that was a very different time when you often had to talk to an operator when you're making an international call or a long-distance call. It was also a time where I think people didn't have the same sort of expectations about the nature of their phone calls being private that they have today. And there's also the broader implications of this. This suit isn't just about phone records. It's actually about all metadata collection. There was a story reported in the New York Times or the Washington Post in late June that revealed that the collection of metadata has actually included internet metadata, again targeted at U.S. citizens. Up until 2011, that program was continuing. It was shut down, according to a spokesman for James Clapper, who may or may not be telling the truth, that this program was shut down for operational resource reasons. But the same rationale that would justify the government using the Patriot Act 215 statute to obtain tangible things, which could include a database of phone records, also applies to a database of email to and from lines or IP address allocation data, which while it may not be the most invasive in the context that it could be difficult to tie that back to an individual, when you start to build this mosaic of information about someone over a long period of time, the risks to their privacy, especially when the information is in the hands of a government that is willing to misuse the information or to use the information to harass innocent people is a serious problem. And then there's also the statutory question, which is, does the FISA, the Patriot Act amendment to FISA that authorized this Section 215, in fact, extend to such a broad scope of information? We'll call it Representative James Sensenbrenner, who was the chairman of House Judiciary back in 2001, and actually was an architect of the Patriot Act, wrote a letter to Eric Holder, the Attorney General, saying that when he wrote the Patriot Act, Sensenbrenner never intended that tangible things would include something so much broader than a specific record or set of records believed to be about a terrorist or a foreign intelligence operative. So I think this suit has a real chance of succeeding where previous ones have failed. Recall that, as you discussed, that the Supreme Court held that the case that Amnesty International brought, represented by the ACLU against James Clapper regarding NSA surveillance, was rejected because the plaintiffs didn't have standing because they couldn't show that they were actually surveilled, just that some surveillance was happening. Now, of course, that problem has gone away because of this leaked court order, which has been, which the government has confirmed is authentic, that says that everybody is being surveilled if they are a Verizon customer who places a phone call in the United States. So given that you've got the standing issue that has gone away, less of a need for discovery of information, which the state might try to quash based on the state secrets privilege, I think that this is the suit that could, for the first time, really create a precedent as it percolates through the higher courts that sets the outer boundaries of where the NSA can go. Of course, it's also possible that Congress may well intervene before then to rewrite the statute, as the House Judiciary Committee in a hearing last week suggested it was considering doing.
Right. That was just a couple days ago, right, where James Sensenbrenner, he might want to rename himself to Insensenbrenner because he was so ticked off visibly in that hearing. And, you know, we're talking about parents policing their kids. It had that feel to it, you know, of if you're not responsible in the way you're using Section 215 of the Patriot Act, we're just going to not let you use it. We're going to take it away from you like we might take away the car keys. So obviously this is a bit more of a serious situation, but it definitely had that flavor of, you know, don't think that just because we've given you some leeway that you can go and hang yourself with it. Evan, what do you think of all this?
Well, I can't add anything to the analysis to what Ryan said. I mean, that was very comprehensive and very well put. I guess I would just say there's no surprise. Given the opportunistic nature of plaintiffs' lawyers, I can't believe it didn't happen 2 weeks ago. The Snowden stuff was in June, right? And we're already, 2/3 of the way through July. What's taking so long here? Why haven't there been all these big class action lawsuits? I can't believe it's taken this long. So,
well, I would know there actually was a suit that was brought by the ACLU and the NYCLU on June 10th, just a couple of days after the allegation. But I read the complaint a few days ago. It was a hastily written complaint. I'm guessing we'll probably have to file an amended complaint. But they didn't do the sort of legwork building a coalition, fleshing out the complaints that the EFF suit did. And also, I believe they filed it in New York, which may not bode as well for their case as does the EFF suit in California.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the ACLU generally does things right. I mean, setting aside whether you buy into their particular leanings on it. I mean, at least in their thoroughness and their investigation, and certainly with the EFF being involved, will be thorough and comprehensive. My comment was kind of a dig at those opportunistic plaintiffs, class action lawyers, who file lawsuits, 2 days after news stories break. So, but these suits that are filed here certainly do, the constitutional analysis, at least on hearing an explanation of it, certainly does make sense.
As far as these suits go, I'm sure they have what they need to go forward evidentially, but it makes me think, Ryan, you hit on the issue that the government has acknowledged these documents that were leaked, but certainly Edward Snowden and maybe others are sitting on other evidence that could come out and be useful in this challenge. And just sort of makes me wonder, you know, how much cooperation they're going to get from the government or how much it may require a court order to come in and say, okay, we have this document. Are you going to confirm its validity and authenticity or not? Because, you know, it seems like the people doing the surveillance aren't under any obligation other than moral and ethical ones to embrace the leaked documents. In fact, their first and foremost reaction would probably be to deny them in most cases. So do you think that that is going to be a stumbling block at all, Ryan?
Well, it was interesting that the government was so quick to acknowledge the accuracy of these documents. My guess is that they did so as sort of damage control more than anything, that if everyone is going to assume the documents are genuine and that the government refuses to confirm it, no, the press is still going to treat them as if they're genuine, if they appear to be genuine, and they have sources that are telling them they are. So, and in fact, after the documents were leaked, the government actually took the step of declassifying other information that Snowden didn't leak. So the government is, in a sense, the Director of National Intelligence and others, are actually providing classified information to the public, not because they want to, but because they are doing so to control damage caused by other leaks. So I imagine that anything that is in fact published by Snowden or Glenn Greenwald or any of the other reporters, at this point, it's going to be assumed to be accurate unless it just looks false, given that nothing that Snowden has leaked so far has been claimed to be inaccurate. It's simply been claim to be incomplete, which I suspect is the case. Who knows if Snowden is not leaking documents that might make the programs look more innocuous than they really are. Although I doubt that there are any such documents that exist that would really make EFF, for instance, think the programs are acceptable. So right. It'll be interesting to see if this litigation goes on. If, you know, Glenn Greenwald doesn't write a story that conveniently publishes a document that EFF is seeking in discovery, but unlikely to get because of the state's assertion of the state secret privilege. That would not be surprising to me, and it could make for, again, an easier time on the plaintiffs here than in past cases, where there wasn't somebody like Edward Snowden out there sitting on an unknown treasure trove of documents about these programs.
All right, so Warren, we've done away with the standing issue. We've got a well-thought-out, broad coalition of folks asserting the constitutional challenge. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, it's really interesting. I hadn't thought about the First Amendment angle potentially with these lawsuits, though I know that it had been filed. But, you know, I definitely think it's a great argument. It's fascinating. But I don't know. I think that ultimately the Fourth Amendment issues, given the scope, and I think Ryan, you know, has his own piece out there that really summarizes it great, that this is exactly sort of what the Fourth Amendment was designed to protect us from. If we're going back to colonial times, when the British had, you know, would serve a general warrant and just sort of go fishing for information. That draws some very uncomfortable comparisons with what we have going on today. So at the very least, I think these lawsuits are going to result in some more. We're going to learn a lot more from about this issue that we haven't found out yet. I think we're going to get some very interesting revelations before everything else is said and done. So I would just – I don't know that they will ultimately be successful, frankly. You know, the Supreme Court handed down something of a surprising ruling, I thought, in the previous FISA of the decision. So I don't know necessarily I can't really peer into the crystal ball on this one. I think there's some very interesting public sentiments. Definitely people who are concerned about technology, they're all, you know, to a large degree up in arms about it. But when I ask, you know, friends of mine, how do you feel about this? Are you concerned about your privacy? I get a pretty resounding meh, which mm-hmm. is surprising to me to some degree. But, you know, there are, I think, a substantial part of the population that is willing to make some trade-offs getting what they see as security in exchange for giving up a certain degree of privacy. And that's an interesting exchange that we see going on in the commercial internet context, privacy for services for free. So I don't know. It's almost like the private industry has kind of trained us to make that exchange, and government has just taken it that step further while in secret to a large degree. So I think it'll be fascinating to see. I'm not necessarily totally optimistic about it, but hopeful.
Right. So Ryan Warren just raised the point I alluded to earlier when we were talking about COPPA, that particularly the complaint that was filed this week does a very nice job of laying out how metadata isn't something to just give a resounding meh, that it can be used to very accurately portray information about people that they might not think about or comprehend. So when you think about those arguments in the context of COPPA, I know we're talking about government actors versus the commercial side, but does it change your analysis at all about information about children, including their IP address?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's certainly true that the metadata, especially when it's collected over a vast time and associated with other data, can provide a pretty good picture of what someone's doing. So I don't mean to say that sort of an IP address isn't something we should be concerned about, but it depends on whether it's a website getting an IP address from one person one time, on whether it also has a co-tracking cookie, whether it's affiliated with your email address, your name, other information like that. But there's absolutely an argument to be made that there is a privacy concern with this when this metadata is being collected. And that also means that in the context of COPPA, that I see why the FTC is looking at IP addresses. But of course, the threat, I think, is somewhat less when you're talking about a company that doesn't have the ability to get like every IP address you've ever been assigned or every IP address your computer has ever connected to, but rather has a narrower snapshot. That sort of there's also, of course, the idea that not necessarily children, but the nature of the internet involves the exchanging your IP address with the computers to which you're connecting. That's part of the way it works, even if many people don't understand it. Whereas having every email to and from line that you've sent end up in some database of some unknown entity secretly, where you can't even find that out if you're litigating, I think is a different level of concern. But they both raise issues that are fair game for privacy advocates.
Absolutely. Well, we're here with Ryan Radia of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Warren Allen of the New York Legal Hackers, Evan Brown of the Info Law Group, and me, Denise Howell, and we're discussing the nuances of privacy law and constitutional law, some lawsuits, both silly and serious, and lots of other good things today. And we're doing that, and this just couldn't be a better sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, partially at the courtesy of ProXPN. We're going to thank our other sponsor a little bit later on, but I think you'll agree that the two of them together are very directly addressing a lot of the issues that we've been discussing today about using the internet in the way it was intended, exchanging IP addresses and all, and doing so in a way that still protects the privacy and security of your data. And that's what ProXPN is all about. It's a global virtual private network, a VPN, that works with almost any internet connection and creates a secure encrypted tunnel through which all of your online data passes back and forth. Any online application can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, your email, file sharing, and instant messaging programs. ProXPN keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location, and giving you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. Now, some people have written to me and asked, you guys are doing a legal show, on Twit here, and you're encouraging people to break rules or break the law by using ProXPN, and that's absolutely not what we are doing. What we are encouraging you to do is take the precautions that businesses have been taking for a very long time. You're not going to run into any upstanding business, certainly not any law firm, that doesn't use a VPN for its online communications because of the nature of the information that's going back and forth, and the fact that those folks know if that information is not kept secure, they're going to be in a world of hurt. They're going to get in trouble with their clients. They're going to get in trouble with the law. So there are times when information absolutely has to be kept personal and private and secure. And a VPN is an excellent way that the business community has been using for a long time. And there's no reason why you shouldn't use it in your private life as well to keep your own families or your small businesses information as secure as someone like a mega multinational law firm. So what you're going to get with ProXPN is complete online privacy through a 512-bit encryption tunnel. It works over OpenVPN or PPTP. You get to choose. You can protect yourself against the ISP's six strikes rules, which have gone into place earlier this year, the graduated response rules, which, again, by protecting yourself against that, we are not encouraging people to go out and break the law and try and hide their copyright infringement from their ISP. But those graduated response rules simply can't penetrate a VPN. And if you are concerned about getting caught up in false positives, getting caught up in some kind of legal challenge to your perfectly legitimate online activity, a VPN is a great way to go. You can keep your personal internet usage private while you're at work, and you can bypass internet filtering and blocked websites if that's an issue for you. You can also bypass geographical restrictions for internet content and online video with worldwide servers in the United States, UK, Asia, and more. ProXPN makes your internet connection region-free, and its software for Windows and Mac offers advanced controls, allowing you to select the programs and ports that you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. It works with iOS and Android devices, allowing you to use your data plan or public or corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy on the go. There's no app required for that. It has world-class customer support, and Steve Gibson on our sister show here, Security Now, gave it his resounding seal of approval, which is no small thing. So go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 a year, but we've got a special offer for you. If you use the code TWIL, T-W-I-L, you'll get 20% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month for the yearly plan. So if you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days and get a full refund. There's no reason not to do it. You've got to go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code T-W-I-L. Thank you so much, ProXPN, for the great product and your support of This Week in Law. So, folks have been all over Microsoft because of information about how it collaborated with the NSA. And we're talking about encryption and how good it is to use an encrypted service. But Microsoft, in its cooperation, of course, I mean, it's sort of is commonsensical that if you're going to be cooperating with the government in its PRISM surveillance program and you're going to have services that encrypt data, you're going to have to help the government de-encrypt that data. So Microsoft has been getting in trouble for that. But meanwhile, Yahoo has gotten an order letting some of its challenges to various PRISM-related requests come out as well and be unsealed and made public. So the FISA court has decided that, yes, Yahoo can have some of the information that will help its PR battle here around PRISM and help people know the extent of its non-cooperation. Evan, do you see anything worthwhile to discuss here as far as Microsoft or Yahoo or the other private companies that participated in PRISM?
Well, I think it's just there's probably not much to say definitively at this point other than these are still moving targets. And there's always a PR angle that the companies have to be worried about on this. They certainly took a beating, you know, in the first few days after the Snowden documents first came out. You know, there was that kind of infamous slide from the PowerPoint deck that it was the timeline when each of these service providers joined the PRISM program. And so there's a certain backlash and diminishment of goodwill in the consuming public's mind, seeing that the service providers involved with that. But, you know, there's so much the secret. There's so much that is not yet ascertained. So with the whole process of Yahoo being able to show its resistance early on, that's definitely a PR win. And with Microsoft, you know, it looks like they were doing some stuff that makes them look complicit, but I think we would be coming to judgment too quickly to say that it really is what it is, and saying that they were complicit in a way that would be too negative. So I think we should just like pause a little bit and let the things get sorted out a little bit more before we start evaluating this too much. That would be my recommendation.
Yep, I agree. Warren, any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with all that. I mean, we haven't seen all of the documentation out there, and it makes, you know, the sort of the conflicting stories that we get, because the service providers and Microsoft in particular, after these revelations, were, you know, they came flat out and really issued strongly worded denials, which have been really broken down too, I know, and, you know, potentially may leave some leeway for themselves, even despite their strong language. But I pulled up one of them, and it was something like, it says, we do not provide any government with direct access to emails or instant messages, full stop. You know, that's, mm-hmm. you know, it's pretty strong condemnation of the reports. And we're sort of getting really conflicting things going on with this. So I'm curious to see more of what we wind up finding. I think the lawsuits that we talked about earlier are going to be a great vehicle for that, despite what Evan might think about potentially plaintiff's attorneys at work in those cases. But also, you know, one thing that's interesting in all these reports is a question of whether they are, you know, required to make such strong condemnations. At least the way the law's written, I don't know that they do. So is there a question of whether these kinds of denials, if they are in fact lying, are potentially actionable for the consumers by making certain representations along these lines? I don't know. It's very interesting. Also, just with respect to the Yahoo point, I think Evan's totally right that it's a huge PR win. And I think that it's potentially, you know, it's one of those things that we've heard a lot about a market for privacy, and it's going to be very interesting to see if a market like that actually winds up emerging and whether these kinds of revelations are going to spur that on. We do see it. I mean, obviously, with respect to VPN providers, we do see services that are specifically tailored. I'm curious if that starts expanding more into the consumer space, where, you know, we do see more and more widespread adoption of these kinds of services and support more overtly from the public of services that are really willing to go to bat for your privacy.
Right. Ryan, any thoughts on the private companies and PRISM?
There was an interesting Twitter conversation last week between Chris Egoyan and Jennifer Granick, where they were discussing the possibility that these revelations that Microsoft, for one, has actually engineered its architecture to facilitate government surveillance might not be Microsoft simply saying to the NSA, sure, we'll help you out. It could be the product of another secret FISA court order that Microsoft is legally not permitted to divulge. We've mm-hmm. seen the Justice Department and the FISA court are willing to be pretty adventurous when it comes to interpreting Section 215 of the Patriot Act, perhaps Section 702 of FISA, which was the 2008 law that basically reestablish the warrantless wiretapping program that occurred during the Bush administration. Perhaps the courts have interpreted that somewhat like the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, which requires telecom companies to basically make their systems wiretap ready. Maybe Microsoft received an order that said, in order to facilitate the government's ability to get this data, you need to take these engineering steps so that encrypted communications can be decrypted. But of course, if Microsoft were to receive such an order, it would be barred legally from divulging that. But I agree with what's been said so far, that we can't jump to conclusions about whether these companies are materially deceiving their users, whether they're gagged from divulging these court orders, or whether they are simply in a position where they wish they could be doing less to divulge information, but they can't. In a world where the fact that Yahoo was the petitioner in this 2008 FISA court opinion that was just recently declassified, what the identity of Yahoo wasn't even known until recently. So the company is in a tough position when, if it wants to challenge an order, it gets none of the reputational or PR credit. It can't tell its users, "We fought for your rights," whether it wins or loses. So it's a dynamic that really doesn't do a good job incentivizing companies to be good actors. And it also doesn't really reward companies that are good actors. So there's just too little information out there to really make an accurate assessment about whether these companies are all telling the truth, which I think is quite possible, whether maybe they don't always know what the left hand is doing. If the NSA director or someone higher than him is calling the CEO directly and only five people in the entire company have clearance, there's just so much we don't know that it's hard to say whether these companies deserve their moral culpability if you believe that this surveillance is problematic, or whether the blame should rest squarely with Congress, the FISA court, and the various executive branch agencies that are involved.
Well, as Congress and the courts and the FISA court attempt to sort out all the fallout from the Snowden leaks, one of the consequences affects the DEF CON conference. Jeff Moss, a.k.a. Dark Tangent, the founder of DEF CON, posted on their blog recently that maybe it would be a good idea if the feds didn't come to the conference this year. Now, that conference is fairly famous for putting the hacker community and the federal information and security community together. But right now, things are just too turbulent. They say the clarification after the media jumped on that and said, "No feds at DEF CON," DEF CON came out and said, "There's a lot of tension in the community right now." And what Dark Tangent was asking politely for was for the feds to consider not attending this year. Shannon, our technical director today, is going, and she says she'll keep an eye out for the feds. So hopefully she can report in if she sees them some there in stealth mode, as you know, they may well be. Not too much more to say about that. So let's move on to something a little bit more lighthearted, but that also has some serious overtones, and that is a college student behaving badly in Southern California. This student, his last name is Weaver. Let me pull up the story here real quick. I don't have it in front of me. Evan, you put this in for us, I believe. And he was attending San Marcos State College in Southern California and decided he was going to try and get himself elected president. But rather than just running for student body president, I don't know, I read the story, Evan, and thought this guy maybe had seen too many superhero or James Bond movies where he cast himself as some sort of dark evil overlord, because he certainly thought that he had superpowers that he didn't have. He got himself some key loggers and installed them on computers around the campus, managed to get student credentials for several hundred students and have them vote for him, and was only caught when the IT staff of Cal State San Marcos noticed a lot of voting activity from one particular computer over and over again, stuffing the ballot box for this defendant and his colleagues who were trying to not just elect him, but also some other folks to other positions so that they could rule the school, as it were. And he got caught. And under federal wiretapping laws, also under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for exceeding unauthorized access, and under identity theft laws, the guy has pled out and is going to do a year of time in federal prison. So, Evan, what lessons can we take away from this? It's Matthew Weaver, 22, of Huntington Beach, California, this student behaving badly.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a bad decision on his part to do this. And you know, we talk a lot about when it's appropriate for there to be criminal actions brought under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, or, you know, the state equivalents, you know, for doing something, accessing a system in a way that's unauthorized. And, you know, here's a situation where it's more than just accessing a system in excess of authorization pursuant to the terms of service. You know, he actively installed software onto these machines to get information that he then used to undertake or to accomplish, to effect even more unauthorized access. And it came to great expense, or it caused great expense. You know, the college had to do the election over, and it messed with something that's really fundamental, at least in our sensibilities. I mean, yeah, this was just student government. This wasn't real government. But at the same time, you know, there's something pretty profane about messing with the voting, the election, you know, the democratic process like this. So I'm just, you know, I mean, if you read my Twitter stream enough, you see that I really am entertained by dumb crimes, you know, when people make really bad decisions. I mean, even since the show started, I tweeted about a guy who was on LSD and crashed his car naked. You know, just why do people do stuff like this? I don't know how on earth he thought he wasn't going to get caught. You know, it doesn't seem like it would take a whole lot of foresight to recognize that students are going to start complaining if they can't log in because their credentials have already been used. So just, you know, put this in the category of dumb criminals. And, you know, so yeah, it's hard to understand why you would think of doing this in the first place.
Yeah, the notion that he thought he wouldn't get caught was just what got me about this story. And I think it's interesting. I was looking through the coverage to try and determine if he installed a software keylogger. It sounds from many of the stories I read like he was using some sort of hardware dongle. There you get to drink. That's definitely one of our TWIL official drinking game words. It raises the question for me on the IT staff and school responsibility side, you know, on this unauthorized access point. If it's software and you've left your publicly available computer open for people to install and run software on it, you know, that's certainly not good practices, but is it tacit authorization? And then assuming it's just hardware and it's some sort of USB based keylogger that I suppose it would have to install something and run.
Go ahead and
something.
Say it again. You can say that hardware again.
The dongle. The dongle would have to install something, but I don't know that much about keyloggers. Maybe the IRC or our friend Deep Geek can help educate us as to exactly what happened in this case and what happens in general with keyloggers. But you know, do you have to block off the little USB port to make sure that you're not tacitly authorizing access of these kinds of things? I don't think so. I don't think that the CFAA, you know, should be read quite that narrowly. But maybe some of you want to disagree with me. Ryan, what do you think?
I think it would be a real stretch to say that if your USB port isn't blocked off, that you're tacitly consenting to somebody putting something in there. You know, from as I understand it, there actually are dongles that could be attached between the USB port of a computer and the male USB end of a keyboard cable. They don't install any software. They passively intercept keystrokes. Really can't be detected. One easy way to avoid it is just to plug in your keyboard to the front of your computer if you have a USB port on the front of it. But then they can install a keylogger inside your keyboard, inside your computer itself. So you really need, you know, the secure physical area around your computer or a video surveillance. So actually avoiding a physical keylogger on a public computer isn't that easy unless you have a pretty robust security measures. And I'm not sure if it would really be cost effective for a college IT department to be that vigilant. Of course, perhaps if this sort of thing becomes more common, they should be. One other point that is that I've agreed with a lot of folks who've been arguing about the need for CFAA reform. Of course, it's been a much more popular push ever since the tragedy involving Aaron Swartz. Evan noted earlier, this is sort of an example of something that I think probably ought to be criminal without getting into whether the exact sentencing was appropriate. To have laws that criminalize the physical or software intrusions on a computer with the intent of misrepresenting your identity and materially affecting something of some significance, whether it's an election or grades or money, that's properly criminalized in my view. Unlike, say, using the New York Times website more than 20 times in a month and getting around their blocks by using private browsing or something. So I think this is pretty clearly on the line of things that the CFAA ought to criminalize if it's going to criminalize anything at all.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, although I definitely have a hard time with this one because of the nature. I mean, yes, you definitely want to punish a kid who decides he's Simon Bar Sinister of the student election and he's going to go in and rig the thing and is so determined and kind of idiotic about how he does it. Yeah, kick him out of school. Yeah, fine him. A year in federal prison, though, I don't know. The other thing that kind of rubbed me the wrong way was the prosecutor in one of the news stories on this told a reporter that she was asked about Weaver's motivation, and she said it was ego from an incredibly entitled young man. And that just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. You know, here you're getting into what this kid's background and motivations are. And I think we should probably be focusing on what happened and the damage. What were you going to say, Warren?
Yeah, no, I would definitely echo that. I think statements like that are part of why it becomes a little bit problematic with CFAA prosecutions. I'd side a little bit more with Ryan and Evan in this case, just because, you know, looking on the facts too, evidently there was he had a $36,000 stipend that he would wind up getting as a result of winning this this student election. So I don't know. There was also clearly a profit and really rising to a level of fraud a profit motive involved here, I think, as well, which makes it a little bit easier, at least in this case. The other thing I was just going to mention is that frequently colleges and universities have some kind of terms of service that either as a student or while you're actually logging into the system that you're agreeing to abide by. And I would guess at least that in most cases, those terms of service are going to be pretty broad, and installing a keylogger would probably exceed those sufficiently that, like, at least in most jurisdictions, it would constitute exceeding authorized access under the CFAA. But, you know, I don't know necessarily if that was the case here, but it seems likely to me.
One of the things that really might have inflamed it, and that's actually the metaphor that the judge reportedly used in this. I think the judge said, you know, he was on fire for this crime, and then he just poured gasoline on it by afterward creating these fake Facebook accounts and then communicating, you know, having these fake people communicate with each other to try to show that he had been implicated. So that goes toward the extent to which he was taking responsibility and trying to deflect blame. And maybe that's what the prosecutor was talking about when he, you know, was coming from this sense of entitlement, a real, you know, I don't know that it's inappropriate at all for us to look at the circumstances around a crime and just look at somebody's complete inability to take responsibility for it and do everything they can to deflect from it. So that was kind of my favorite part of the story, was the cover up. And even more so was how the judge said he was on fire and then just poured gasoline on it by doing that. I thought that was pretty clever way of saying it.
And also, and just as a note, sorry, just as a note, with each one of those fake Facebook registrations is also probably, again, depending on the circuit, I guess, but is another CFAA violation to lump on top of it.
Didn't even think of that. Yeah. This guy, the 1 year, that's all he got? He needs 30.
Well, He bled out, yeah. Oh. And kudos to the local news organizations covering it that apparently did not jump on those fake Facebook accounts and say, oh, there's now evidence that this defendant was framed. So they did their journalistic homework and figured out what he was doing there. So let's make Simon Bar Sinister our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We've been discussing lots of good stuff. There's lots more in our public rundown if you want to check out everything that we've been reading and what Ryan has been writing in one instance at least. Go to delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/220 and you'll get all the links for today's show. Now, I mentioned before when we thanked ProXPN that you really should put both our sponsors together for a nice, secure private information package. And you'll see what I mean when you go check out sharefile.com, because when you're using ProXPN to give you that nice 512-bit encrypted tunnel, this is, you know, the suspenders to that belt is ShareFile, because it's also going to keep your online communications secure. And here's how it's going to do it. You oftentimes have large things that you need to send to people. And of course, doing it in email doesn't work. You're going to get bounce backs. There's no assurance, number one, that it's going to get to its intended recipient at all. And number two, what's going to happen to it once it gets there? So ShareFile by Citrix definitely takes care of those problems. It's the better way to send and receive files of almost any size. You can easily and securely send everything from large documents, PowerPoints, video files, anything that you're concerned is going to take up a lot of storage, or even small things that you just want to keep very secure. Files are sent as a link. You don't get any bounce backs, and you can track when the file is downloaded. You can also set access controls so you know it's secure. Plus, ShareFile allows you to store your files in the cloud so you can access them from anywhere, your laptop or your mobile device. You can work on the go. It's perfect for everything from legal files, huge stacks of exhibits such as we use in the legal world, media files that are used in court and evidentiary settings all the time, videotape depositions, all kinds of contracts with huge exhibits. If you're in the legal field, this is definitely for you, but every business has its share of large files that it needs to get back and forth, and even individuals do too. So whatever category you fall in, I want you to try ShareFile with this special offer. Sign up today and receive a 30-day free trial with no obligation. Go to sharefile.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. That's sharefile.com, and type in TWIL. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law and your great, very business-friendly product. Okay, so we've got a lot more in our rundown and precious little time to wrap up the show. Evan, go ahead and pick something we haven't talked about yet, and let's do one more story.
Oh, gosh, I am at a loss. I've got to look at our list here. We talked about the guy with Safari, right, who filed the lawsuit. That was the big one. Oh, we've got to talk about the Asiana airline stuff, don't we? Those names.
You perfect know, that, way to go out. Yes, we right. Serious lawsuits and silly, we promised you. Here's one that was so silly that Asiana actually backed off. I guess it issued some sort of public statement that it was going to sue the, I think it was KTVU and perhaps one other station in Northern California, over the racially insensitive, however very funny, false names of pilots for the crashed Asiana flight that the poor news announcer read live on the air. As someone who reads copy like I just did for the ad, I can't tell you how much I sympathize with that poor person who read the Sumting Wong and Wee Too Low names of the pilots. The airline was initially going to sue, but I think they just finally figured out that that would be way too silly and didn't do it. So, Evan, did they make the right choice?
Well, for sure. I mean, one thing's for sure. There's nothing funny about either aspect of this when you think of it in, on the personal level and the personal, you know, human tragedy that, that goes on for all this. But it does, you know, put us in a position to worry about what, who should be responsible for that, because to the extent that people were finding it funny, others were finding it offensive, and the airlines was trying to do the right thing managing this extreme crisis. I mean, there's absolutely, there couldn't be anything worse in the business life of airline executive and decision makers than to be facing the public relations and all that stuff after a crash. So, you know, they were between a rock and a hard place in figuring out what to do. And, you know, this threat of the lawsuit just really was, I don't think the right way of handling that. It drew more attention to it than what was necessary. People in the IRC are already saying, you know, the Asiana Streisand effect and all this. Mm-hmm. You know, we wouldn't be talking about this blunder, this error, this oversight, whatever it is that happened, or how the prankster got those names through to the news reporter, you know, for those to be put in there. Because what's really weird also, just kind of as an aside on all this, the news reports about the erroneous news report are saying that an intern at the NTSB approved, you know, looked at these names and approved them. And if that's true, that poor intern, you know, was either just, you know, made some, you know, great oversight or whatever here. So, you know, these are terrible things that happen.
He may wind up doing time with Matthew Weaver.
There you go. I mean, this is a terrible thing that happened, and just on top of something that's even, you know, orders of magnitude even more tragic, the crash itself. And so, you know, it's a difficult way to figure out how to sort these things out. But threatening lawsuits is, you know, usually not the right way of doing it.
No, not at all. Warren, as someone who's closer to internship status than probably any of the rest of us, do you have any particular thoughts?
Well, actually, I think I heard the intern was fired. So he really definitely paid the price for making that mistake, which is a pretty huge one. I don't know. I think this was just, again, a lawsuit that wouldn't have been particularly successful in all likelihood if it had actually gone ahead. My understanding was they were trying to claim defamation. I think, frankly, they didn't wind up in defamation claim, you know, which is a false statement published in bad faith, if I remember all my factors right. But you also need harm to the person who's bringing the defamation claim. I don't know that there was any real harm that they could realistically claim was done to their reputation as a result of that. Frankly, the worst reputations harmed were the journalists who read that aloud and the intern who confirmed it and was then fired. So I don't know how well that would have gone off. Now, there are cases of defamation per se, I know, where harm is effectively presumed, and there are some bizarre cases that have been brought under that. I know, for instance, like, it's slander per se in New York to accuse a woman of unchastity before marriage. So, you know, that's something that, you know, there might be some kind of crazy exception where someone could bring a case of saying that it was a defamation per se claim, and they didn't need to prove harm ultimately. I don't know that would have been particularly successful either. I don't know if there is a exception for the defamation per se rules that really is would have gotten in. It would have just been so far extreme as to catch something like this. I mean, this is really just an insult case, I guess, ultimately, that most, as far as I know, all defamation law does not actually protect against.
Wow, that may have to supplant our tip of the week, although it won't, because our tip is a good one. But yeah, don't call someone unchaste in New York, I guess. And it's a good thing the Jersey Shore is filmed in Jersey. Any thoughts, Ryan, before we move on?
Truth is a defense.
Yes, that's true. Ryan, any thoughts on this non-defamation lawsuit?
Well, setting aside the suit itself, I'm, you know, an aviation nerd, so I've been following the NTSB investigation of this crash. And as far as I can tell, the NTSB has actually been doing a good job investigating this carefully. So my fear is that this NTSB in turn confirming the obviously absurd names will be used by the airline Aegean, which is a Korean airline, to portray the NTSB as culturally biased or anti-Korean. So when the NTSB does issue its final report, which I suspect will probably offer some pretty important tips, advice to Korean airlines, how they can better train their crew to avoid things like this happening, that this will give the airline one reason to discredit the report, which from an aviation safety perspective is, I think, a bad thing because the NTSB probably will find some pretty foreign conclusions. So let's hope that this intern mishap doesn't distract from serious aviation safety concerns that this crash, I think, revealed.
Yeah, definitely. All right, let's get to that tip of the week. We've talked about the fact before that there was floating around for a while on Windows machines some ransomware that purported to be an FBI site that played on people's fears about their online activity, whether they had engaged in anything unlawful or not, told them that they were subject to violation of copyright and related rights laws, have been distributing prohibited pornographic content, various other things had been going on with their computer. Illegal access has been initiated from your computer to do wrongful things, etc. Just really scare tactics. And what they would do is lock up the browser and tell folks that their computer was locked up unless they entered a code and paid fees. And these ransomware malware folks have actually made some money off of this, preying on people's fears. The tip is that apparently it's been ported over to the Mac using a weakness in Safari that whenever Safari crashes and you restore it from crash, it can latch onto that and hijack the browser and make you feel that your computer's been locked up and you perhaps have to pay this false fine to the FBI to get your computer data back. Of course, that is not the case. It's just a scam. And there's some good information over at Malware Bytes Unpacked about freeing your browser if you are a Safari user who has had this happen to you, and restoring it to its proper status. But don't let someone bully you into thinking that the FBI is going to seize your computer or your browser because of your nefarious, quote unquote, online activity. We have a couple of great resources of the week for you. The first one is from the Internet Association, and it is a markup tool for legislation. The Internet Association is a group of private, a very large group of private online companies, including Google, and let me see if I can run down the whole list here, but lots of players you've heard of. Path is in there. Whole bunch of folks in the net industry who are paying attention to law and policy, and they're using a tool that lets you, as you're giving feedback to your congressperson, not just say whether you're pro or con a piece of proposed legislation, but it lets you get into and read the legislation and say, okay, this totally doesn't make sense to me, or this provision is incomprehensible and needs to be clarified. So it's a really nice tool from the Internet Association that lets you not just, you know, register your thoughts with your elected representatives, but go into some detail about hacking the law, Warren. So you guys must be fans of this kind of a tool.
We love stuff like this, definitely. Actually, the first legal hackathon that we did when I was still at Brooklyn Law School, we actually were looking to do something very much like this, to have something where you could have really crowdsourced legislation to a certain degree. And we've seen that come up more frequently. I know with the CFAA reform, we had a couple of different proposals. I think Orrin Kerr and some of the other people who were proposing revisions to that bill were allowing, really, you know, just throwing it out there and letting the public mark it up, which I think is a really interesting way of looking at legislation in the future.
So basically, internet companies, oh, plenty, are involved in this. eBay, Expedia, Airbnb, Ask, About, Zynga, Amazon, Facebook, on and on and on. So lots of folks throwing their weight behind the Internet Association and this markup tool. And it seems like, Ryan, this kind of a response to a legislator might have more impact than just clicking a box and sending an email, don't you think?
Yes. You know, I've met with staffers and they've said, well, send us a red line language. Sometimes they look right at it, sometimes they don't. But, you know, a lot of times the a big challenge in legislating is converting the principles into workable text. And to the extent that this can advance that, I think that's a good thing for improving the state of the law.
Okay, and we have one more resource for you. We are in the throes of Comic-Con in San Diego. And it is cranking along and has some really wonderful panels that are right in line with the kind of things that we do on the show. EFF wrote it up. Dave Mass over there pulled out from the schedule all of the great panels at Comic-Con you might want to attend if you're the kind of person who is a fan of what EFF does, is a fan of this show. There's a person of interest panel about what happens when you combine predictive technology with big data collected through video surveillance. There's an intelligence panel, the spying power of the NSA, and more, direct access to the global information grid, Wi-Fi, cell phones, satellites, all channeled through the brain of Sawyer from Lost, or at least Josh Holloway. The premise of intelligence, another show set for February 14th. There is just all kinds of great stuff going on at Comic-Con. Comic Book Law School, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, Cory Doctorow's doing a couple of things there. So go check it out. It's over at the Deep Links log at EFF if you're attending Comic-Con or may want to run up there to catch some of these great sort of legal substantive talks going on at the show. I've always thought it would be fun to attend just for entertainment. But now when I go, Evan, maybe I can write off my ticket. What do you think?
Well, that is a quite impressive list of topics. Really interesting. Not what I had thought of traditionally for Comic-Con. So it would be a lot of fun. Wish I could be there.
All right. Well, guys, this has been really, really fun and informative. We've gone from the silly to the sublime, as we like to do on the show. And we couldn't have done it without the help of Ryan Radia from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. It's been great having you, Ryan. We're so glad you could join us.
Thanks for having me. It's been good to be on. I appreciate it.
Anything you want to tell us that's going on at CEI or with you that folks should know about after the show?
Well, we're focusing right now a lot beyond the privacy issues on the future of copyright. And there's going to be a hearing before the House next week before the recess. So keep an eye out for our work on that issue.
We will do it. Thanks so much. Also, it's been great chatting with Warren Allen from Legal Hackers. Congratulations coming up on your one-year anniversary. And anything you want to plug, Warren?
So one thing is just we have a meetup coming up on August 29th at General Assembly in the city where we're going to be talking about innovation in legal applications, actually. So we're going to have some really cool companies in to talk about making law, making legal, not quite advice, but services at least, more widely available through applications and just through the internet overall. So that should be a really cool discussion, talking about, you know, making these services more widely available to people who wouldn't necessarily otherwise be able to afford them. So there's that. And then also I should announce that we've got a really cool thing planned for October, which is another legal hackathon. And I think that'll be, you know, if you want, check out our website, which is underneath my name right there, legalhackers.org, or go check up meetup.com/legalhackers, if I remember correct. And you'll definitely see updates on that. And also, I should say, you know, any views or opinions that I expressed here, you know, they're my own, and regardless of whether they're talking about unchastity or anything else. So those are all just mine, and I just want to throw that out there too. And thank you so much again. It's really a pleasure.
It's been great chatting with you too. Do you have a topic for your legal hackathon? I know last year you did SOPA PIPA and trying to come up with anti-infringement legislation that made sense. Have you honed in on anything yet for this year?
We haven't specified it yet, but definitely we'll be making some announcements very soon, and they should be pretty exciting, I think. So definitely, you know, keep checking our mailing list, and you know, you'll see some stuff, which should be very cool.
All right, we'll look forward to that. Evan, so nice to have you back.
Yes, great to be here. Fridays just aren't the same without being on the show. So really have enjoyed our conversation. Lots of great topics, and really nice to participate. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure, as always. It's been really, really fun today with all of you and with all of you listening and watching, which we hope you'll do with us live when we record the show on Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC at twit.tv. But if you can't join us live, do go check out our entire archive of now 220 shows at twit.tv/twill. You can also find us on YouTube at This Week in Law there. And also, you know, we're in iTunes, we're on your Roku box, wherever you like to enjoy this kind of educational entertainment, we're going to be there for you. And we're just glad to have you join us any way you can. When we're not doing the show, we hang out on Facebook and Google Plus, interacting with folks who are giving us topics and ideas for speakers and things to discuss, different slants on the stories of the week, facebook.com/thisweekinlaw, This Week in Law on Google Plus, and you can always hit us up in email or on Twitter. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. He is Internet Cases on Twitter, and I'm Dee Howell over there. We love to hear from you in any or all of those ways. Thanks so much for supporting the show, and we'll see you next time on This Week in Law.